On May 19, 1975, two men approached 59-year-old Harold Franks outside of a Cleveland, Ohio grocery store, demanding his briefcase. Franks resisted, and the men clubbed him with a pipe and splashed acid in his face before shooting him twice in the chest. The shooter fired into the grocery store as well, hitting co-owner Ann Robinson, who survived. Mr. Franks, however, did not. An eyewitness wrote down the plate number as the assailant sped off in a green convertible. Despite the plate number and other compelling leads, police instead focused on the word of 12-year-old Eddie Vernon, who had been bragging about witnessing the crime from a bus, repeating an alleged rumor naming Ricky Jackson, as well as Wiley and Ronnie Bridgman, as the assailants. Vernon's classmates and the bus driver denied even having the vantage point to see the crime. During interviews and at the lineup, when Eddie Vernon tried to back away from the lie, the investigators threatened to lock up his parents if he didn't stick to the story. By ignoring more compelling suspects and instead coercing a child, the state sent Ricky Jackson, as well as Wiley and Ronnie Bridgman, to death row. When the 1974 reinstatement of the death penalty in Ohio was struck down as unconstitutional in 1978, those condemned between those years had their sentences commuted to life, including Ronnie, Wiley, and Ricky, assuring the possibility of their innocence one day being recognized. This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today's story is important in so many ways. The man who lived through this, well, four decades of imprisonment on the basis of an eyewitness who wasn't there, who was 12 years old at the time, who was coerced, pressured, browbeaten by authorities, the same authorities who overlooked or ignored evidence pointing to the actual two assailants and what was a brutal, brutal crime. And I'm very, very honored to have the man himself, Ricky Jackson. Ricky, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Jason. I appreciate it. Thank you.
So let's set the stage here. When I tell you the name of the place where this occurred, people are probably going to be given some knowing nods in their car or their home, wherever they're listening, because it feels like every other episode we do is a wrongful conviction based in Cuyahoga County.
Well, when you look at the number of exonerees through Cuyahoga County, it justifies the statement you just made. At least in those times, the police pretty much owned the prosecutor's office, the coroner's office, whatever they sent up the pipeline, nobody went against the police.
No, that's right. And so your story, as you were telling me earlier, is important because if it could happen to you, it can happen to anyone. And when I say that, you lived a relatively normal, peaceful life growing up. You were only 18 when this happened. You were still really a child, let's face it, but, you know, turning into a man.
I mean, back in the mid-70s, you know, life was not as hectic as it is today. And I was doing the typical 18-year-old stuff. One of my friends, Wiley Bridgman, he had joined the National Guard. He came home one day on leave. We saw that uniform and we were so awed and impressed and amazed by that, that we immediately set our sights on joining the military, you know.
And you joined the Marines, right? And then were honorably discharged for medical reasons?
Yes, I was doing a detail and the driver pulled off before I had a good firm hold on the back of a dump truck and I fell off and my back hasn't been the same. I thought I was going to be able to get out, rehab my back and re-enlist. But in the process of doing that, Eddie Vernon happened.
Yes, Eddie Vernon happened. That's a hell of a way of putting it. It's very direct. It all comes down to this kid. And I'm talking about it. He was a kid. He was 12 years old. I feel that he's a victim in this as well. I don't know if you share that belief.
I do. I strongly share that. I mean, he was a 12-year-old kid.
Yeah, and at 12 years old, we know how easily influenced you can be and how easily scared you can be at that age. And then a lie just grows into
something you can't control.
Yeah, it grows horns and it gets worse and worse. So Eddie Vernon, was he just a kid from the neighborhood? Did you guys know him?
He used to be our paper boy at one time. I remember when I used to come home from school, to have lunch in the wintertime. He would be sitting at our kitchen table. My mother would like give him soup and a grilled cheese sandwich or something like that because it was so cold outside before he continued on with his route. I mean, because of our age difference, I never, you know, hung out with him or anything, but I knew his family.
The crime itself, this is a crime that happened on May 19th of 1975, when 59-year-old Harold Franks, who was a money order salesman, he was leaving a grocery store on Fair Hill Road in Cleveland, Ohio, when two men approached him. The men confronted Mr. Franks and demanded his briefcase. And this is where it gets really crazy. When Franks resisted, they clubbed him in the head with a pipe and splashed acid in his face. What kind of sick people are these? And one of the men then shot him twice in the chest and fired a shot through the store's glass front door, hitting 58-year-old Ann Robinson, who was the co-owner of the store. She was shot in the neck, but somehow miraculously survived. Mr. Franks tragically did not. The two robbers fled with the briefcase. Remember, I said two robbers, containing $425 and some blank money orders, and they escaped in a green car that was parked down the street. Did you have a green car, by the way?
No, never. I didn't even own a car.
Okay. Man. So, and by the way, there are three guys convicted for a crime that two guys committed. That's just one little fraction of the problems with this case, as we're right. going to find out as we go along.
May 19th, the crime had just happened, not 200 feet from where we lived, the three of us. And so, you know, we saw people gradually going towards the Fair Hill area. And so we asked, like, what's going on? You know, and they're like, somebody just got killed up at the store. We didn't have nothing to do at the particular time, so we decided to go up there and be looky-loos as well. We got up there, and by the time we reached the location, the police were up there. There were TV cameras out there. The police had the area cordoned off, and there was a body with a sheet laying askew. And I saw Eddie Vernon at the scene of the crime, and he was looking around like everybody else was. And so we stayed up there for approximately 15 to 25 minutes, and we left.
The investigation involved detectives Eugene Turpe and James Farmer, as well as numerous others. They had the license plate number of the green escape car. This case came with instructions. That escape car belonged to a guy named Ishmael Hickson. And they were also pointed, when I read this, my head about exploded, okay? So get this, everyone. They were also pointed in the direction of Paul Gardenshire, whose own mother contacted the store owner and the police to report that her son had a gun and that she believed that he was involved in the shooting. Oh, my God.
The same caliber gun, mind you, of the gun that was used to kill Mr. Franks.
The guy's freaking mother came forward. And then another informant also implicated Gardenshire, who said that he stole his grandfather's .38 caliber gun, which was the murder weapon, and was driving around in a convertible that was, yes, you guessed it, green in color, and that was the escape car. These details were not public knowledge at the time, right? So this is inside information. And Officer Turpe found the green convertible exactly where the informant said it would be. I'm getting the chills now.
There were a lot of viable suspects. The FBI even got in contact with the Cleveland Police Department and told them that you need to be looking at these guys right here. They have an MO of throwing liquids in people's faces when they rob them.
Oh, my God. You know?
And, you know, the police for a time went down this road. But when you got a 12-year-old boy saying that he was an actual eyewitness, you know, they're not going to spend all that time chasing these leads of what might have been when we got an actual witness.
And of course, you're referring to Eddie Vernon, who, had he actually seen anything and had you and the Bridgemans actually been the culprits, he could have pointed you out to the police when you were all at the scene right after the crime had occurred. But the fact is, he hadn't seen anything, as he admitted so many long years later. He was actually on the bus with a bunch of his classmates at the time of the crime. They all heard the gunshots, but none of them had a vantage point to see anything. It was not possible for them to see the crime, not even the bus driver, who would have had the best view. So from what I understand, there was a rumor that you and the Bridgemans may have been involved. We don't know how this rumor got started. Maybe there wasn't even a rumor at all. Maybe your name came from the cops. Either way, it's hard to know. But how the hell does Eddie end up as a target of police coercion and get forced into making a statement implicating you as well as Wiley and Ronnie Bridgman?
Edward Vernon was running around the neighborhood telling people that he had saw the whole crime and he knew who did it. And so, you know, eventually this got back to the gentleman that owned the store where the crime took place. And so he tracked Edward Vernon down, took him back to the store and started grilling him like, if you saw who did this, you need to tell us. And so the store owner got the police involved, and then the police started putting the screws in Eddie Vernon. But upon talking to this 12-year-old boy, even for a rookie police officer, it would have been easy to tell that this kid was fabricating a lot of shit, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably an insecure kid who wanted to be the center of attention, so he went out and told people he had seen the crime. Well, and that's what started this whole snowball effect. And then the police get this tunnel vision, and they decide that they don't really care about investigating the crime. In fact, when they did investigate the crime, what investigation they did, they collected physical evidence from the scene, but inconveniently, none of it matched you, Ronnie, or Wiley. So the evidence that they did have, which again should have been the giant red flag, ding, 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 that should have been it, right? All of that evidence pointed to other people, including the license plate number of the green escape car, okay, which they had.
I mean, and all these people had armed robbery on their rap sheets.
So no other investigation was conducted into these or any other leads. Once Eddie Vernon came forward, all the other investigations stopped, and they focused on you three guys with absolute total tunnel vision.
They pretty much kidnapped this kid, you know, and they told his parents if they ever tried to get involved or ever tried to stop them from coming to get Edward, that they would prosecute them. They had complete and total control of this 12-year-old kid. And so this began the process of molding Eddie Vernon from a liar into a lying witness. They pretty much had to build this case and give Edward Vernon information as they went along, which is why his testimony and his statement changed from day to day, you know, because they were feeding him information. He didn't see what happened, and so he had to create something. And they kept the pressure on him. Fast forward a few days later, the three of us were coming home from a party. It was about 1 o'clock at night. And my dad had this policy when he locks his doors at night, all in ain't getting in, you know. So it wasn't uncommon for me to, you know, go sleep at the Bridgman's house, who stayed just a couple of houses down from me anyway. Just as I was nodded off, I saw lights going by my window, you know, flashlights. And before I could get my whereabouts together, the door was exploded in. The room was filled with police officers with guns, lights, and they were shouting my name and were shouting the Bridgman's names. They got me first because I was right there on the couch in the front room where the door was kicked in. So they grabbed me, threw me to the floor, knees in the back, handcuffed me, asking me where the Bridgman's at. And I was so confused. I didn't know what to say because I was horrified. I mean, it was just like a total shock. But by the time they drug me outside and had me on top of a police car, I could look down the street and see my entire family. I could see my entire family stressed out in the street, and every one of them had a shotgun pointed at their heads.
This episode is underwritten by global law firm Greenberg Traurig. Through its pro bono program, Greenberg Traurig leverages its more than 2,400 lawyers across 42 offices to serve the greater good of our communities and provide equal access to justice for all. In the field of criminal justice, Greenberg Traurig attorneys have exonerated and freed a man in Philadelphia, represent numerous individuals previously sentenced to life for crimes committed as juveniles in resentencing hearings, and received the American Bar Association's 2021 Exceptional Service Award for death penalty representation for their work on 5 death penalty cases. GT is reimagining what big law can be, because a more just world only happens by design.
it became obvious to me that they had hit my house first en route to the Bridgman's house. And they finally got the Bridgman's out of the house. And I mean, we were still just totally in shock. We didn't know what the hell did we do. We had just came from a party. There was no incident at the party. So we are totally confused as to what's going on. Not knowing that this is all related to that man having got killed a couple of days earlier up in Fairhill. We didn't know this at the time. We had no clue. We get downtown the next morning. We go into a lineup. They do their thing. They let us out. Unbeknownst to us at the time, Eddie Vernon was standing behind that two-way glass, and he refused. He couldn't pick anybody. He didn't pick anybody. And so the police never told us we were free to go. Instead, they took Edward Vernon in the back room, a 12-year-old boy, unescorted by a parent or a lawyer, took him back in the back room, and they threatened him. They told him that they couldn't do nothing to him because he was a kid. But if he didn't pick us out in that lineup, Ricky Jackson and Wally Bridgman and Ronnie Bridgman, that they would make sure that he never saw his mom and dad again. They would send his mom and dad to prison for a long time because he started this process and now he had to finish it. And so while we were outside in the common area making a phone call to call our folks and say, well, you know, they haven't told us anything, so I guess you can come and get us. He points us out while we're out in the common room with hundreds of other people, prisoners or whatever, making phone calls. And a couple of hours later, they called us and told us that we had been indicted for murder and they were seeking the death penalty. And that's when we found out that Edward Vernon was a kid that was saying that he had saw us do this. It was just mind-boggling because my mind instantly went back to that day when I saw him standing there at the scene of the crime like everybody else in the neighborhood, you know? And like, why wouldn't you say to the police, because there was plenty of police there, that's him right there.
Because Eddie Vernon never saw a freaking thing. Nothing. He just told a lie, like many little kids do. And then he got roped into repeating that lie in an arena where the stakes were, well, life and death. And so on May 25th, 1975, you, Wiley, and Ronnie were all charged with aggravated murder, aggravated attempted murder, as well as aggravated robbery. And the trial started that August. You guys went to trial. The prosecution's case rested. Well, there was nothing else other than the testimony of this little kid who was now 13. His testimony was all over the place. He initially told the cops that he was on the bus coming home from school when he saw two men attack Mr. Franks as he got out of his car and walked to the store. But at trial, Eddie testified that he had already gotten off the bus when he saw the attack and that the attack occurred as Franks emerged from the store. So very, very different than what he originally said. That should have been a huge flag there as well. Ann Robinson, meanwhile, testified, the woman who was shot in the neck, that she had been shot by a bullet that came through the store's front door, but she was unable to identify the robbers, understandably so. And a 16-year-old neighborhood girl testified for the defense, saying that she walked into the store just before the attack and saw two, not three men outside the store, and that neither of the two men were any of you three guys. Very brave young girl. Several of Eddie Vernon's classmates testified that he was on the bus with them when they heard the gunshots, but that none of them were able to see the robbers.
During the course of our three separate trials, we had nearly every kid on that bus testify in our behalf about what they saw, where the bus was at that time. And there was like 10 or 12 kids saying the same thing. You know, he couldn't have possibly seen it. We were all on the bus together. He didn't get out before we got out. We got off at the same stop. And the bus driver, he's got the best seat in the house. You know, but he didn't see anything. But it was so easy to inflame an all-white jury when you got a black person accused of killing a white person. You know, anything you have to say on your behalf, they're really not listening to that. You know, let's just get to the part where we execute this dude, you know. And that's pretty much what my trial boiled down to, you know. I mean, the judge even said during a recess that he didn't believe the state witness for 1 minute. But I'm not going to take the power out of the jury's hands. That's your job as a judge. If you have a witness, a key witness, you're talking about executing three people. And you say, outside of the court record, I don't believe this kid for a minute. He's lying. I saw him being coached out in the hallway, but I'm not going to do anything about it. And when you're up against stuff like that, there's no way you can win.
And let us not forget that in so doing, and not just the judge, but the prosecutors, the cops, and everybody else who was involved in this fiasco, they're also allowing the two guys that committed this disgusting crime to remain free.
Thank you for bringing that up, because it's a point I try to make so often about the uncounted victims that our false imprisonment possibly created. We'll never know the numbers.
You guys, meanwhile, did have alibi witnesses who testified.
I hate to keep saying this, man, but whatever we had to say, yes, we had a lot of witnesses. You know, my mother, I mean, timelines, everything. But all they want to know is, like, when is we going to hang this nigga? And that, I'm sorry to say that, but that's what I felt like, you know. It didn't matter what we had to say. It didn't matter that the evidence was shitty. A white man is dead and somebody needs to pay for it. If they didn't do this, they probably did something else, you know? And that was the prevailing attitude. How can you be prepared to kill three young men based on almost absolutely nothing? But they were willing to and didn't blink an eye about it. I spent 2.5 years on death row. I came within 2 months of being executed. This has got to stop. For a long time, I thought that this was just a racial and an economical issue, but this happens to everybody. I know a lot of exonerees from around the country, including Hawaii, you know what I'm saying, that had professions, they had children, they were happily married, and they got caught up in this same madness. They got caught up in this same madness. And when it's you against the state, guess what? You're going to lose every time. You are going to lose every time because they don't have to follow the rules. And if they get caught, guess what? There's no repercussions.
Right. Imagine if a suspect went to a 12-year-old kid and threatened him, "I'm going to take your parents away from you. You'll never see them again unless you do exactly what I say and you lie like I tell you to." I mean, we all know that no one's allowed to bribe a witness, but the government can offer them plea deals. I can threaten them. They're not supposed to threaten them, but they do. But they can definitely offer them plea deals, and that's the best bribe of all. So it's like, yeah, you have no shot in hell. You're absolutely right. And you had no shot in hell. So in August of 1975, you were convicted along with Wiley, and Ronnie was convicted in September, and all of you were sentenced to death, later commuted to life in prison, which is like a living death sentence. What was your experience of death row?
The moment you got back there was always this feeling of impending doom, like it was right around the corner. You know, you had two options: go crazy or you accept this and make it work for you. You know, I was on a mission anyway. You know, I was innocent, you know, and I wasn't going to lay back here waiting for my death date. And so between my workouts, I wrote so many letters. You know, and they cut the lights off at a certain time in prison. So you got to get up on the bars and, like, get the little light coming out from the security light outside. And I'm up like 2:30 in the morning just writing anybody that would listen. You know, like, I'm on death row. My execution date is so-and-so, so-and-so. I'm innocent. My two friends are innocent. Look into my case, you know. And that's what I did. Worked out, made friends back there. You know, you survived, man, as best you could, you know. Like I said, but it was always that impending doom. While I was back there, you know, the Ohio State legislature was in flux about what they wanted to do with the death penalty. And so they placed a moratorium on executions. And that's what eventually got everybody off of death row during my stint back there. But life in general back there was like, you don't have a life. your life is on the calendar. You know, you can see the end of your life. It's on the calendar. So you live from day to day and hope something comes down from the United States Supreme Court or the Ohio Supreme Court that's going to spare your life. You know, things could have went the other way. This interview might not ever be happening today. My daughter might not be here today. My wife, my other children, things could have easily went the other way. You know, it's not uncommon for innocent people to get executed. It happens all the time.
So I know you had been writing letters, a very powerful image you gave before from death row, leaning up against the bars to get what little bit of light you could get. So you had written probably to everybody and their mother by this point. But how did you manage to get the Ohio Innocence Project to take your case? And when did they get involved?
I think it was around 2005 when I first wrote them. They were just themselves starting up. I contacted them and I gave them the particulars of my case. It was a long process. I mean, because they vetted everything that you send them and say to them, because they only deal with totally innocent people. I said over a period of like 3.5 years, I got a letter from them saying that they had decided after reviewing my case to take our case. It took another additional 3 or 4 years, you know, to get to the point of the recantation from Eddie Vernon.
So, okay, 2011, Cleveland Scene Magazine published a very detailed examination of the case and highlighted the many, many inconsistencies in Vernon's testimony, as well as the absence of any other evidence linking you, Ronnie, or Wiley to the crime. And the article pointed out that Vernon had been paid $50 by Ann Robinson's husband to testify at the trial. Okay, now $50 in 1970, whatever it was, to a 12-year-old kid probably was a lot of money. But besides that, there's all the other stuff. But that was a fact, most importantly, that Vernon had failed to mention in his testimony, that he had literally been paid for it. Okay, so Kyle Swenson, the reporter who wrote this article, attempted to interview Eddie Vernon, but he refused to talk about the case. So Swenson reached out to Vernon's pastor, Arthur Singleton, this Swenson guy, man, I'd like to buy him a beer. When Singleton mentioned to Vernon that the reporter wanted to talk to him, Vernon brushed him off, telling him to ignore the reporter. But months later, Swenson sent his article to Singleton, who asked Vernon about it. And still, Vernon refused to talk about it. In 2013, Singleton paid a visit to Vernon in a hospital where Eddie Vernon was being treated for high blood pressure. Singleton later said in a sworn affidavit that he asked Vernon again about the article, and this is a direct quote. Eddie Vernon told me that he lied to the police when he said he had witnessed the murder in 1975, and he had put three innocent men in prison for the murder, end quote. And then another quote, he told me that he tried to back out of the lie at the time of the lineup, but he was only a child, and the police told him it was too late to change his story. End quote. Singleton said that Vernon then broke down and wept. And he said, quote, I could see the weight being lifted from his shoulders, end quote.
By then, I and myself, Ryan Howe, Mark Godsey, and the rest of the team were quite familiar with each other. I get a call one day, and Brian said, I could immediately tell that it was something I've been waiting for a long time. I didn't know what it was, but I knew just by his attitude and the way he was trying to keep his composure, I knew it was something big. And when he told me that Eddie Vernon had recanted his testimony, being a lawyer that he is, the great lawyer that he is, he was like, yep, this is great, but it's not the end of the journey. You know, now we have to get a judge to accept this. And I got to tell you, Ricky, recantations are the hardest piece of evidence to get before a judge. You know, once a witness makes a statement, that's it. But we're going to see what we can do.
So now, after this recantation, Ryan Howe and Mark Godsey at the Ohio Innocence Project filed a petition for a new trial on behalf of you, Ricky Jackson, and similar petitions were later filed on behalf of the Bridgman brothers. And the Ohio Innocence Project's reinvestigation of the case uncovered evidence that when Vernon attempted to recant his identification of the three defendants, police intimidated him to testify falsely. The police had never disclosed to the defense attorneys, to any of you guys, that Vernon attempted to recant his accusations prior to the trials. Of course, if they had, it would have blown the case up. So, of course, they didn't, right? Because they were just deep in their own lies now. So police reports obtained by Ohio's Innocence Project also showed that police considered the two other men, Paul Gardenshire and Ishmael Hickson, as suspects, but their investigation was terminated as soon as this young kid falsely identified you three guys. And of course, lastly, the license plate on the green car seen speeding away from the crime was matched to a car belonging to Mr. Hickson, whose record, his long rap sheet, included a robbery and a shooting a year earlier. Back in 1976, a year after the Franks murder, Hickson pled guilty to over a dozen counts of aggravated robbery. So now we get to 2014. Judge Richard McMonagle held a hearing on your motion for a new trial. Eddie Vernon testified that police had fed him the details of the crime. A direct quote from him, "I don't have any knowledge about what happened at the scene of the crime. Everything was a lie. They were all lies," end quote.
Edward Vernon was the catalyst to all of this. He got all of this started. He got us locked up. But in the end, his testimony is what got us freed. Anybody that was in that courtroom, in that gallery that day, hearing him from the witness stand, left no doubt in anyone's mind that this was a guy that had made a terrible mistake. And now he's sitting here, everybody against him, everybody hating him, but he's sitting up here and doing what he know he has to do. And he did it, man. He really did it. And so I know a lot of people can't understand this. People like, "I don't care. I still would hate him," or whatever. Well, that's y'all's problem to deal with. I don't have no time for it. You know, I'm just giving credit where credit is due, because his testimony and his candor on that witness stand was tantamount to us being free here today.
So Vernon told the judge that he was on the bus when he heard two pops that sounded like firecrackers. The bus was, you know, in the neighborhood, in the area of the store, but not near enough to the crime scene that he could have seen anything that took place, just like all the other kids on the bus had said. But based on a rumor he heard on the street, he went to the scene and told police that you three guys committed the crime. He was thinking at the time he was doing the right thing, he said to the officer, and that he knew who did it. But he testified that he had tried to recant, but the detectives took him to a room, just like you said, into a room, and told him that they would arrest his parents for perjury and he would never see them again, et cetera. So he agreed to testify at the trials. So he was just a traumatized kid at that point, and I can't even imagine being in his shoes, much less yours.
The court had decided to take a brief recess, and the prosecutor went to the bench, and they talked to the judge, and they took me back into my holding cell. And I was in there about a minute, and my lawyers came in and said, "Rick, they got a proposition for you. They said if you plead guilty right now to all the charges, they'll consider sitting served and you can go home today. And we got to have a decision right now." I mean, nothing in the courtroom was guaranteed. This was guaranteed, you know, plead guilty and you can go home today, but you're going to live your life as a convicted murderer. It only took a few seconds when I told my lawyers, like, "You know what, man, I'm innocent. I done came too far. At this point, I ain't got nothing to lose. I'm going to stay with the hand I was dealt." We went out there. We went back out in the courtroom and proceeded with the proceedings. And after most of the testimony, the pertinent testimony, the prosecution once again went to the bench. And I heard the judge say, "Are you sure?" in a whispery tone, and the lady nodded, and they went back to their prospective benches, and the judge asked me to rise. He said that the state was not going to, you know, they weren't going to pursue me anymore. In other words, they weren't going to try to prosecute me anymore. They really believed I was innocent, you know, and it was just that simple, man. After all that, it was just that simple, man.
So Cuyahoga County Prosecutor Timothy McGinty said, and this is very powerful, he said, quote, "The state concedes the obvious." Wow. McGonagall adjourned the hearing, granted motions for the new trial filed by you and Wiley, and vacated your convictions. Ronnie's conviction would later be vacated as well. The prosecution then dismissed the charges and you were released after 39 years, 3 months, and 9 days. And would you say 4 hours on top of that? And at that time, you were the longest serving defendant exonerated in U.S. history. We know that there are others who served longer that we never heard their names because they were never freed. But this is the flip side now, right? This is the good part. This is the good stuff. This is what I live for, right? So tell us about that moment when you were finally vindicated and released and walked out into the first free air you had breathed in almost 40 years.
I guess that's one of the quirky things about all of that. You know, it's just saying those simple words, guilty, innocent, just those simple words, man. But it took so much and so much time to get to that point. Honestly, I was kind of subdued because I was tired. I was tired, but at the same time, I was grateful because I had made it through the ordeal. And I felt like I was stronger than they were, but it was more tremendous relief than actual glee and happiness. You know, it was just like, man, it's nice to be able to breathe again, you know? It was a great moment, man. Everything after that was like I was on cloud nine, you know? It was just a great relief, man, to be free, you know?
So ultimately, all three of you guys were compensated. I wish I could say that for most of the people that are on our show.
Yes, and it's a real tragedy, man. And
it should be automatic. It should be you walk out of prison with an apology and a big check and a chance to start your life anew. But even the people who do get compensated normally have to wait years, or typically have to wait years and years.
I can attest to that, trust me.
And now, luckily, thankfully, you have been compensated. There's no amount of money that would be enough, but it does give you the freedom to be able to live out your days in relative comfort.
I'm 65 now, you know, and I've been fortunate enough to be surrounded by people who have given me so much, you know, and helped me navigate the world that I've been absent from for 39 years. And, you know, trust me, man, if I didn't have the help, man, I'm still lost today. I've been out here for almost 6 years now, and I'm still kind of lost compared to what a lot of guys got. Man, I had it easy, man. I cannot lie. This is a social problem. This is our society. This is our America. You know, when I became an exoneree, always before that, I always thought it was black people because that's all I ever saw. Black people on TV getting exonerated. But my first exoneree conference after I got out of prison, I saw people from all manner of life. They have an innocence project in Hawaii, and that boggles my mind. I've been to Hawaii. It's paradise. Why would you need an innocence project over there? But it just brings back home that we need it everywhere, you know, because justice isn't perfect anywhere. And it just opened my perspective upon like, man, this just isn't an inner city black problem. This is an America world problem, you know, but there's a lot of stuff you can overcome, man, you know, and I'm living a great life right now. And I try to live my life as an example of what it can be like. I mean, not a perfect life now, but I'm living a life that I love. And a life that I used to dream about in my prison cell every night, you know.
Now, Ricky, without further ado, the best part of the show is the same every week. It's called Closing Arguments, and it's the part of the show where I, first of all, thank you again. I'm going to turn my microphone off, kick back in my chair with my eyes closed and my headphones on, and just listen to anything else you want to share.
At the end of my journey, you know, I know a lot of people say, I don't know how you're so calm, cool, and collected, but you needed to be there to understand why I am the type of person I am today. Forgiving, understanding. Yes, I get mad sometimes when I think about, I just had a baby 2 years ago. My daughter's about to turn two, my first child. I think about all the time that I'm not going to have with her. And I kick myself in the butt for that because I need to be thinking about the time I do have with her. But sometimes those thoughts creep in. Like my mother died while I was in prison, you know. And it's just stuff like that, you know. It's okay to reminisce about the time you lost, but you can't get caught up in it, you know. You can't get caught up in it. You have to appreciate what you have right now. And that's what I'm doing. I have a beautiful wife. I have three knucklehead stepchildren and lovely the daughter me and my wife had together. We got three dogs. We have a beautiful home. And I'm blessed, man. You know, the easiest thing to do is to be angry and bitter. You know, I'd rather be happy and get out there and try to change the system. Channel that anger and bitterness and resentment into doing something, man. Get out there and help somebody, because somebody helped me, you know. And I'd be a complete asshole if I would just sit here and didn't try to help anybody else.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Jeff Clyburn, and Kevin Wardis, with research by Lila Robinson. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrong Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all three platforms. You can also follow me on both TikTok and Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.